Adam, how did it take so long to get around to landscapes?
Are we doing the show?
Yeah. Well, I'm recording, so
okay, because we don't have to do the countdown or anything.
Well, govern yourself accordingly.
Have you never touched this topic before?
No.
Never.
No, this is episode 143, and we have yet to touch it. So, Adam, what's the reasoning behind that?
I don't really do it.
Are we doing the show? Hello and welcome to episode 143 of the Two Hosers Photo Show. My name is Alan in Tübingen, Germany, and with me as always is
Adam, Vancouver, Canada.
And guess what? Guess who's back?
Don from Barrie, Ontario, is back.
Canada.
Canada too.
I said, guess who is back? And you,
I meant, was I supposed to guess?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, you guys just do the show. I'm sour now. I'm not sour. Happy to have you, Don.
Oh, well, happy to be here. Thank
Although
so
I was given a list of funny names I could have said, places that you were from. One of our listeners, I think, is from where you grew up.
In Sudbury?
Yeah.
Oh.
He doesn't know you, though. He doesn't know you. Yeah, I think he still lives there, maybe.
No, that's too bad.
But anyway, so he found it funny when I always get the town wrong. And then he sent a list of, I had him send a list of funny names of places that you could be from that aren't.
You requisition this list of names from a random listener?
Correct.
Oh, well.
And
then you didn't use any of them?
Well, no, because you jumped in with from Barrie, Ontario right away.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll be quiet next time and you can put that list to use.
Yeah, this is riveting stuff.
Let's just try this one from the top.
No! I'm not starting again. We're on the clock here, man.
All right, sorry.
Do you want to go again?
No,
just joking. So what's going on? What's going on, Don? We're happy to have you back. We're going to talk about landscapes later on, but first of all, give us an update on the book.
The book, which has nothing to do with landscapes, mm-hmm. is going very well. My snowflake book. The files are into the printer, and I've gone through two rounds of proofing with them, and everything's looking good. In just a couple of days, probably when this is airing, I will be on my way to Quebec, where the print facility is located, and I will be doing an on-site press approval for the book. So that'll be exciting, and as soon as I give the thumbs up, then everything gets set in motion. And about 2 weeks later, I get a big delivery truck filling up my garage full of books.
Great.
Do you have a big stamp that you just can slam down on each copy saying approved?
No, but I will be autographing every copy that goes out to all of the people that contributed to the crowdfunding campaign. So I guess that's something of my stamp of approval.
So do you have a different autograph? Obviously, you must have a different autograph than your, say, bank signature.
No, it's all the same.
Really?
What, do you have two separate signatures that you use for different occasions?
Yes.
Oh.
One's an X, one's a Y.
Ah, there you go. I'm not that sophisticated.
Well, when I sign autographs, which is never, sure, you don't want to sign your bank signature, do you?
I never thought of this.
Well, now it's important that we bring it up.
I don't think that there's a concern, really. I think that everybody has just one signature. Nobody's tried to forge a check or
bank. Oh, I beg to differ. I guarantee Alec Baldwin signs differently. Of course, I think instead of signing, he just punches you in the face, if you ask. But
I guess so. I don't want to put myself on the same level as Alec Baldwin.
I think I just did, Don.
No, I don't think that's... I don't have to worry about the problems that celebrities have.
Okay. Well, I'm going to suggest you get a special Doncom signature lined up.
So now at the bank, I'll just sign with a stamp.
Right.
I think you can do that.
Okay. Adam, do you have two signatures?
No.
Okay, good. Moving on then. So I missed the date, or maybe you didn't say the date. What's the expected date of delivery for the book, if you had to guess?
mid-October is the rough date, although they haven't confirmed solidly exactly what that'll be. When it does arrive, I will start to organize things. I'll be shipping out international copies of the book sooner than everything else. So, you know, more travel time on those. Everything out of province will go out after that. And on October 26th, I will be having a launch party here in Barrie. And all are welcome to attend and pick up a copy of the book if you've pre-ordered one, and or buy one if you haven't gotten one yet. And I'll be doing a couple of events around there as well, speaking at different camera clubs and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it'll hopefully everybody will have their book before Halloween.
That sounds great. Did you ever see the movie Spinal Tap?
No.
Yeah, check that out when they do their record signing. Anyways, just as a heads up.
Okay. Thank you for that.
When did you? When did the,
also a funny movie though.
It is a very funny movie, especially that one scene though, which might actually, is it in the movie or is it in the outtakes? I forget now. But the when did you start doing the crowdsourcing, the crowdfunding?
That was done much earlier this year, in and around the April timeframe,
right?
Late March, early April, and I gave a 60-day window to gather the needed funds to do an offset printed run of a book, and because that's not very cheap to do, I needed the support of everybody, and man, everybody came in and helped out. I raised almost twice what I had expected to, and so that allowed me to not only make the book bigger and better, but make more copies of it, because 100% of the money has been gone. It's been going into the production costs, and now I'm effectively net zero. And so I'll probably lose money shipping things out to people, but I'll make money on all the remaining copies of the book, assuming that it does continue to sell. Otherwise, I've put in 2,000 hours over 4 years for not a whole lot of anything. But I'll have quite a few copies of the book left over that'll make it worth my while. And of course, give everything back to everybody that contributed.
But what ends up happening is, so you start in April, and 7 months later, you have your first book published, ready to ship. That's impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, not just on your end, but I mean the whole technology end of it too, but obviously on your end too, to go from having an idea for a book to having it published in 7 months and funded is, I mean, I have a ladder upstairs here that it's been sitting here for 8 months. I haven't taken it downstairs. Okay. So having a book done.
Yeah, and it was a huge time sink through most of that. You know, just being almost full-time work on this one book project, editing images, and then towards the end, putting all the pages together. I've been something of a one-man show, doing all the page layout and graphic design, did all the writing, and of course all the images and the editing and that kind of stuff. I had somebody else help me with the grammar in certain parts, and I had some scientist guys go over some of the facts to make sure that I wasn't off my rocker. But for the most part, it's just been, you know, me wearing all hats, and it can be stressful, you know, trying to fill in all those different positions.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah. Look forward to it.
Looking forward to having it done.
Yeah, I'll bet. Adam.
Yes.
Did you shoot anything interesting this week?
Oh, I shot my video that we talked about. That was it.
We mentioned, we didn't talk on the air about that.
Didn't we?
That was off the air.
Oh, I shot my Flash Junior trailer.
This is what we were getting at dawn. Is for Halloween, Adam bought a costume, a Flash superhero costume for his son.
Ah,
and he thought, hey, well, I'll just, you know, split the shipping in two, and I'll get one myself. And
pretty much, that's pretty much how it went.
So he has father and son Flash costumes, and so. I think that the ideas were flying around the room. I don't know whose idea it was, but the idea came up that, hey, you should do a father and son Flash trailer. And so that's what he did.
Yeah.
It's
and
good.
I figured I'd get it done by next Halloween, but I actually did it in the day. I probably did it in the 2 days after our last podcast. So I did it pretty quick.
Man, you got your coverage.
Yeah,
you got
your
shots. You got wide shots. You got close ups and stuff like that. And actually, I'm surprised and happy to say that it cuts together.
I'm glad you liked it.
It's not easy to do.
No, and it's not easy to do with a 4-year-old as your main actor.
No, I don't imagine it is.
He's born for the spotlight.
Yeah, he was super keen because he really likes, you know, being the Flash. And each morning since we filmed the footage, whatever, earlier in the week, he's been asking, is it done yet? Is it done yet? He wanted to see the movie. So this was on the forefront of his mind. But
I see. No,
I basically did it all on the digital SLR on a tripod, and the opening scene that I filmed of myself just on the tripod and jumping in the movie myself, no one else around, because if you watch the trailer, you'll know why.
Mm-hmm.
My costume is rather snug.
Right.
Yeah. So anyways, but yeah, no, I had a vision, and you helped me with sort of the concept, and so I got it all together pretty quick and put it up on our Facebook. I'll probably send maybe we can put a link up on our website or something for those who don't want to go through I think you said there's a problem with people in Germany watching it or something. Is that a YouTube issue?
No, well yeah, it's blocked by it's a licensing issue.
Okay.
Long story, years ago you couldn't put stuff like that on YouTube. Now you can put like copyrighted music, essentially.
Right.
You can use it under some sort of fair, not really fair use, but you can use it, and not in Germany though. So it's blocked. Germany hasn't made that agreement with YouTube to use that kind of stuff.
Well, can we just throw up the actual movie itself just on our website though?
Unlikely.
Really?
Now that gets into a whole different issue of now I'm doing copyright infringement directly without doing the licensing.
And is it just the music, or is it the music. Like the? Okay, well, like I can do something else with the music.
You can go get a 99-cent track from a place. I'll send you the place I use. I use royalty free music in certain situations, like in most situations when I do commercial stuff. And there's actually a great place that you can get really good background music for about 99 cents, and it's fully licensed and all in the up and up, and we'll play.
Okay. Well, we'll figure something out so we can get that up. But for the rest of you who aren't in Germany, it's on our Facebook site.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so here's the thing.
Out.
Why? I mean, I want to know why Jack is so into the Flash. Lana Lang, Lois Lane, Mary Jane Watson. These are just I can name the girlfriends of some superheroes. No idea. Mm-hmm. Does the Flash get chicks?
I think he does, but I have no idea what. I just remember the television series from the 90s.
Okay.
I used to watch that, and I used to have some actual comic books way back when I was a kid. But I have no idea where Jack even knows this superhero, other than maybe he's on a placemat, or you know, he's got some app, like some superhero app for the iPad or something that he's played. So again, otherwise I have no idea, because it's not a, there hasn't been a superhero movie about the Flash, and there's no TV show on currently. So I have no idea where that came from, but that was all his doing. He wanted to be the Flash for Halloween. So that's what we did.
He's going to get a lot of candy. You know how many houses he's going to cover in that short amount of time?
Yeah. I think he's setting his hopes high this year. But yeah, so there it is, the Flash trailer, got it done. So now I'm off the hook for the rest of the year for shooting any more video.
Yeah, it's a commitment. Don, anything interesting this week?
New stuff. I'm building a new computer, and it's not going so well.
Okay.
So
you know they have people in China who do that.
Yeah. I think it's an issue with the RAM. I need to get a different set, something to play around with. So very technical stuff. I've been pulling out my hair with technical problems all around. But I have been able to get out shooting once in a while. And so I did a private workshop with a couple of people, and took them out to a few of my favorite spots, and showed them. We wanted to take a detailed look at macro photography, water droplets, and then play around with some editing and do some focus stacking and that kind of stuff. It was very successful, and I usually don't take my camera out, but I was doing some examples with my infrared camera, and I snapped a few shots along the way. One of them is my challenge photo for today, so I was able to get out and do at least some shooting.
Well, hang on. Do you do infrared macro?
I haven't done much of it yet. I photographed a couple of bugs and that kind of stuff, and they look okay. There's nothing too fancy about it. I will see what a snowflake looks like in infrared, but I'm not holding my breath for anything fantastic as a result.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
And hopefully with the fall colors, I'll be able to get out and do some more macro photography and some nice abstracts and some nice colors and that kind of fun. That's... And what have you been up to, Alan?
busy, but I did shoot some stuff this week. Shot a bunch of portraits for some people, which I'll post at some point. Some samples, just in the house, just some white wall, gray wall, some cookie stuff like that. But one shot I did accidentally get that I liked, and I posted it on Facebook the other day, was a picture of my daughter in front of a blue door.
Uh-huh.
And what I liked the best about it is it was really simple to do. It was just open shade, all 100% available light, no added lighting, and it was just managed to grab a nicely well-lit image with nice colors without messing around. So that's cool. It. Look for the good light and go from there.
Great.
Photo challenge this week. So in anticipation of Don coming on the show and talking about landscapes, I said, hey, let's do landscapes. And Adam said, what did you say to that?
I said, great.
I said, yes. I can't
wait. No, it's not something that I'm good at. So definitely a challenge that I was not looking forward to.
You know what? That's the same for me, because you know, you think landscapes, you think, well, that's easy. You know, take your camera outside, focus somewhat reasonably and fire away. That's all you got to do. Deal with the rest in the AM. It's just, you know, it's just sitting out there. But landscapes are really, really hard to do. And now I proved that this week. By ripping my hair out, just the gray parts, though. I left the dark ones, but pulling my hair out trying to get a good photo. So we'll talk about how to do it, but let's talk about our photos first. So Adam, tell us about yours. I'm guessing this is the dike down in Steveston.
Yes, it is. I had one shot to do this because it's been crappy all week, and then it was nice on yesterday, and I had a bunch of things to do. We were going to meet the teacher night, and I was getting home from work, and I thought, I have a 15-minute window, so where am I going to go? I went down to the dike, one of my favorite spots, and I just waited for some bikers to come by. Not because I had to. I took a few sort of sample exposures first, and then I just thought it needed something. Like, the dike, the mountains, the grass, the path, that's all fine, but I mean, to me, it needed something else. So some bikers came towards the camera, and then to me, it seemed like then the photo became completely about the bikers coming towards the camera. So I sort of sat and waited, and a couple came by, and I snapped their photo, and I just liked the added color and the little bit of context in terms of what people do on that path. They either jog on there or they ride bikes, and also because they're away from the camera, I thought it added something, and it didn't really distract too much. And then it kind of, I don't know, it's just a picture of where I live other than that.
All right. Don, what do you think of it?
You know, it's got some good elements in it. The bikers add some nice color contrast because they're wearing different colored jackets. And those colors aren't found anywhere else in the scene, so your eyes can get a little bit of attention in those areas. But there's some dead space in the scene that really doesn't let you visually move through the image all that well. If you were to take this photograph and crop off a chunk of the sky and a chunk of the foreground, it would be a little bit more concise, and you'd have a little bit more of a flow, in this case, from right to left through the scene, sort of following along the path of the bikers there, making the bikers almost the foreground and middle ground elements in the frame.
I also, up on my screen anyway, and I did check the histogram, it looks a little bit underexposed and a little bit muddy to me.
Yeah.
Like a little flat. Now, did you use a polarizer?
No.
Okay, it looks like you...
I just underexposed it. Right. And just, again, trying to get the deep blue sky and figuring that the bright enough colors in the jackets, the contrast stood out. I didn't want to wash it out by bringing it up. But no, like I said, literally did this in a few minutes. And so just went for the dark sky.
In post, I mean, you a simple fix I would go for would be just to manipulate the curves a little bit, just to add some contrast to it. Is that where you would start, Don?
Yeah, well, you know what might be a little bit more of a radical place to start is flip the image horizontally so that cyclists are on the other side of the frame. They start on the left, and they're biking sort of towards the right. Having an image that reads left to right versus right to left, at least for us speaking English and reading sentences and things that way, might be a bit stronger of a composition. But right now, when you've got an element far on the right that is your leading element, sometimes it can be a bit of a struggle to see where the flow in the image will lead. So while I agree that adjusting the curves or even simply the levels can bring up the brightness to where it should be for the scene, I think the bigger change might even simply be just flipping it.
See, Adam?
Hmm. Yeah, this is why I don't take these photos.
The thing is, what upsets me the most is I told Adam all this before he took this. I made a note strictly all about this stuff, so
yeah,
you disappoint me. Let's have a quick look at mine. And once again, I mean, you guys go ahead and start. I'll rip myself when you're done.
Go for it, Adam.
I have no real problem with it other than I kind of feel like the top of the image is a little too tight. Like I just feel like the trees up on the top left, just it all seems too tight. It feels like it should be a wider shot.
Mm.
You've got a lot of the water and the reflection. I like the reflection, but I just it's uneven.
Absolutely, that's one of the things I don't like about it is the asymmetry of it. The issue I was dealing with is this little pond is wildly difficult to shoot because you're basically it honestly has like a 6-inch path around the pond. So if you one false slip, you're in the water. So that was an issue, and it's really difficult to get in a good position where you can get a good shot of these trees reflecting. And two, and Adam, you know this as well as I do, when you have kids, it's not like you can just, wander off at magic hour and go shoot some photos, right?
Right. Right. Very true.
So that was an issue because the sky is, blah. It's just nothing there. No clouds. It's just kind of a gray wash. And so consequently, I didn't want to shoot too high because you're right. I would have rather included some of that. But there's just nothing there. So I think you and I have the exact same feeling about this image. There's nothing really wrong with it, but that's not a winning endorsement.
Right. I would say there's a few things that could be definitely improved in it, though. I'm looking around the scene. A few.
At least.
I'm looking around the scene, and you've got a lot of trees that are not in the light, so they're in shadow, but they're in the foreground, coming in pretty much all corners and all sides, mm-hmm. and they're a bit distracting. They're not leading directly towards the subject. They're not adding towards the general composition, but they're there in every corner, and it kind of adds a bit of clutter. And your eyes go to these little spots, and there's no real reward for looking at them. And so that can be a bit distracting.
Yes.
The same thing is true of the sky. Like Adam had mentioned, it's cropped a little bit tight, but it's sort of on the boundary of, well, you could go either way. You could add in more sky or cut it off entirely. And in a shot like this, if you were to zoom in on just the trees and maybe even have the vertical lines of the trees hitting the top and bottom of the frame, and you can offset this because, having perfect symmetry might not be all that perfect. You've got some fallen down trees off on the left-hand side, and you can keep those in part of the composition to make it asymmetrical but still, balanced and reflective and all of that. And there's some on the far right as well, just a small little one off on the side that can help balance that out too. So if you were to take that and just go in right on the center of that frame, then you're playing a little bit more strongly on the lines and the colors within that scene and making them more prominent.
Okay, A, I tried that and it didn't look good either. And B, a mosquito bit me in the face while I was shooting this.
Oh, boo-hoo.
Yeah. My face.
I think...
The moneymaker.
I think that there would be potential if you were to zoom in on the scene. Now, you'll have to take into consideration a few other things. Were you using a polarizer?
No.
Using a polarizer in a scene like this, especially with foliage, will richen those colors, and that'll make a more dramatic scene. You'd get rid of some of those reflections, which creates a bit more clutter and glare and problems, and be able to play a bit more solidly on what you have in the scene. Now, I can't see from the file that you've sent how much clutter and stuff that there is if you were to zoom in on those trees. Because you're right, if you go into a smaller section to try and simplify it, but it's still too busy, well, then you're not any better for it.
No, you're just polishing a turd at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, and the thing is, I had a polarizer because I brought a couple lenses with me. I had the 17-40, which I shot this with, which I do not have a polarizer for, which I don't even know if a 17-40 can handle a polarizer, to be honest with you. But I also have my... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, the wider you go with a polarizer, when you start polarizing something, the effect appears the best when you're pointed 90 degrees to the sun.
Right.
And if you look or turn the camera closer towards the sun, you'll see the effect diminish. If you're shooting with an extremely wide-angle lens that covers a good chunk of that sky, or anything, the sky's a great example because it's the most obvious use of it, you'll see the sky get darker and then lighter towards one side, depending on which direction you're pointing.
Right.
And wider angle lenses are notorious for this, and they are not the best suited for using a polarizer with.
Hence, I didn't bother to buy the step down ring, step up ring, I guess, in this case. I'm not sure for it. But the point is, I don't have a polarizer to fit my wide angle anyway, and I wouldn't for the reasons you just said. I did have it on the 50, and I brought that with me. So I really would have shot this with my 50, except for I'm balanced on that little 6 inches of earth between the trees and the water. And I felt bad enough as it was just sitting there with my camera thinking, if I go in, I'm going to have to hold the camera above my head. And so there's no way I was changing lenses in that position.
How deep's the water?
I don't care to find out.
All right.
So
your level of commitment disappoints me.
Said the guy who shot the one out the back of his window. The kicker is I have tried to shoot this particular pond. I don't care to try to count how many times I've gone out try to shoot a nice landscape of this pond because it freezes up in the winter and it, you know, to my eye it looks cool, but I can never get the right vantage point to get a good shot at this
pond.
What
time of the day was this photographed at?
I managed to go in the evening, so this was around 5:30. And so we're on the similar parallel as you and Adam. So it's about the same time for you.
And when you're shooting landscapes, of course, golden hour will give you some nice rich colors and shadows too, and they really help define your subject in just about any type of photography. But in landscape photography, the morning golden hour can add a few extra incentives. And I am not a morning person. Talking right now, we're recording at what is it, 1:30 in the morning? Mm-hmm. But it's if you get the early morning just after sunrise. Mm-hmm. On water like this, you might have mist start to form. And that mist can help simplify a composition because it can take the clutter from the background and fade it out. And, of course, add some more drama and depth throughout the scene. So I'm not sure if you've been to this particular pond in the early morning, Alan, but if there is the potential for mist or if you've got, you know, you see fog coming in on the forecast, get out here to this location in the early morning if it's at all possible and see what the scene will change to. This time of the year, mist and fog are a little bit more common, so it's something to look out for.
If I do get up at 5 a.m. and get out there and there's no mist, I'm going to lose my mind. Just as a heads up. So,
all right.
Okay, let's move on to yours, because I think yours, despite the fact that yours is in funky infrared, it would have been better even if it was taken with a point and shoot, so let's have a look at yours.
All right.
It would have been better than ours, I'm saying. It wasn't better than yours. I'm saying... It would still beat ours if it was with your iPhone.
I got it. I understood it.
What I'm trying to say...
We can move on.
Okay.
So, do you guys want to comment on it first?
It's good. I like it.
Yeah. But let's skipping... Okay. I mean, it definitely looks cool with the infrared. You took it with your modified 5D, correct?
Yeah, so this is taken with a modified camera in infrared light. And one of the reasons for that is because in infrared, the sky becomes much darker. And I suppose the scene could have been done in color. And then, you know, playing with you know, black and white conversion, you could have gotten fairly similar results with color. But in a scene like this, you've got many different shades of greens and yellows, and that can be somewhat distracting if you've got too many of them and too many different elements of color, too many different elements of detail and depth. And so sometimes black and white can help simplify that equation. And I love doing infrared stuff. I've been playing around with this a lot, but it's not the be-all, end-all to this kind of work. It's a different way to look at the scene, but like you said, Alan, this type of shot could have turned out well using any camera. Mm-hmm. Some of the elements in here that I wanted to include is, of course, you want to have in a landscape a foreground element, a middle ground element, and then a background. Something that doesn't really matter how they're spaced out, but something that just guides your eye through the scene. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, the two swans in this particular pond or this little river do exactly that. They help anchor, give little anchor points for you to visually navigate through the landscape. We were standing on a little observation platform, and these swans, thankfully, you know, the opposite side that you can't see, they've got big ugly tags that are you know, stamped through their wings. I guess they're captive animals. So, but that's not present here. It looks pristine and natural, and you can't really tell that it's not all that much. And so I have those connecting elements, and that's sort of what I was going for. The clouds were in the perfect position as well. The sky had a fair amount of drama that day. And I waited for this is the second time we came to this location. The first time it was overcast. And I waited for the sun to come out, which makes the foliage in infrared glow quite a bit more, which would make the lily pads on the water stand out much brighter than they normally would be compared to the clouds and everything else around mm-hmm. them.
Okay. What I like the best about the swans, well, it's, first of all, overall good scene. I like, you know, the clouds pop. I love all that. But what I like best about the swans is like that. They're like that painting from Goodfellas. One's looking one way, one's looking the other way. But also, they're both very clean. There's nothing cluttering them in particular. Like, you can see all the way around them.
Yeah, there's space around the birds. So, like, the one in the foreground has black around them. The one in the background has some reflections and stuff, but nothing that's overly detailed and mm-hmm. nothing cutting into them in any way.
There you go. Adam.
Yes.
Correct. Adam says yes to your picture.
Yes, I like it. Yeah.
I do as well. So, with that, let's get into landscapes in general. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, it's one of those things that you know, you think is very, very simple, and yet when you go do it yourself, it's very difficult to make a shot that really stands out. So, first of all, what are landscapes? If I say to you, go take a landscape photo, what does that mean?
Well, it has to include, I think, primarily the natural, you know, for lack of a better word, landscape that's around you, where the features of the land, the environment that is around you, are the main elements to play with compositionally within that photograph.
So, can there be man-made stuff in the shot?
Of course. Now, some people, like if you're going for like a nature landscape kind of shot, then some people want to be a little bit more pure with it. But, you know, in all honesty, you can have like a cityscape, I would consider a landscape, where you've got the, like I've done some great shots of the shoreline.
Well, that would have been a good heads up before I did my challenge, man.
Well, you know what? You interpret it how you want.
Yes, I did. No, that's what I did, though. It's actually difficult, especially difficult here in Europe, to go and find natural landscapes without having any man-made structures in them. Because right. I actually tried a few days prior to this. I went out what I thought was the middle of nowhere, and there's houses or, you know, TV towers or stuff like that. There's still stuff around, and I really wanted to go pure, like you said, and have no man-made things in my shot.
And I guess some of the pioneers in landscape photography rarely kept or rarely put man-made objects in their photographs. And it became something of an odd tradition since then. But by no means do you have to hold to that. I'd say that any feature, whether it's man-made or natural, within the environment that you're in is fair game. But it has to be... it has to be more than just one single object, I think. It has to be it has to have depth. It has to have something in the foreground, and then it has to follow through a far distance away from the camera.
Okay.
And cover a large amount of physical space, I think, is a good definition for what a landscape should be.
So before we get into that part in more detail, because I want to talk a little bit more about that, what do you need? What kind of stuff do you need to go get a good landscape photo?
Obviously just about camera. Anything.
Okay.
You need a camera. The focal length for this kind of stuff it will completely vary, because I've seen some great landscapes made with 17 and 24 millimeter lenses, but I've also seen some great ones that pick out one small area of a larger picture, but it still would qualify as a landscape with a 500 or 600 millimeter lens. Any lens is capable of doing this, whether you're shooting with a 50 millimeter prime or something dedicated to any other area of photography. I typically find that the lens that stays on my camera most for this kind of work is my 24-105. It gives me some flexibility to zoom in and choose different elements to include or exclude from the scene without me having to dig into my camera bag and switching lenses, because I'm less likely to do that. Any camera works, so a digital SLR, of course, is what I use, but as long as you can visualize and compose a scene, you can do just as well with a point-and-shoot camera. There's no special advantage. There's all the little stuff that we could get into the nitty-gritty and pixel peeping about, but a point-and-shoot can work for a landscape photograph just as well as a medium-format camera or anything else.
Tripod or no tripod?
Depends on what you're after. A lot of times if I'm doing, if my landscape includes like water that I want to slow down and have a slow shutter speed, then absolutely having a tripod handy is worthwhile. I didn't use a tripod for the shot that I submitted, and for a good number of my landscape photographs, I might not, depending on where I am and what I'm doing and how fast I have to work. Having it handy, though, is a good way to slow yourself down. And if you're using a tripod and slowing yourself down, you'll be able to compose a little bit more carefully and pay attention to some clutter that might be around the edge of the frame. I know that in, Adam, your picture, there's a building that's sort of half in the frame, half out of the frame on the right-hand side as well. And so... Yeah. Sitting down with a tripod, you can carefully align yourself and say, let's move the whole thing a little bit further to the right or the left and take another look through. And so it gives you just an incentive to sit down and ponder what you're about to take a picture of before you actually do. It gets rid of the run-and-gun kind of feel of it.
I did bring a tripod with me for mine, and I used it on a number of shots, but not the one I chose. Not surprisingly, I actually had worse photos than the one I submitted. But one of the things I did, I thought I was just I was going to try to be different, and I took one of the shots with a pinhole thing, a pinhole lens cap. For have you seen those for the DSLRs?
I have one, yeah.
Yeah, and the pinhole shot I ended up taking with a 30-second exposure, it turned out really, really bad. But I did use a tripod for it, of course.
Yeah, I've never had much success with the pinhole photos, except for a fun experiment. I've seen some people do some really interesting pinhole stuff with a makeshift neutral density filters in front of it to do photographs of the sun for 6 months at a time. Uh-huh. And then you get all these interesting streaks through the sky as the sun rises and falls as the seasons progress in its path through the sky. So there's all sorts of fun stuff you can do with them, and landscapes are good for it.
There you go.
But it's not part of my usual kit that I carry out with me.
No. And I think I expected more for my $4. So so anyways, aperture. We'll talk about aperture. When you get out there and you take landscapes, what is your f-stop?
Well, it depends on how close your closest subject is, or your closest object in the frame, and how far away the farthest one is. Oftentimes in landscapes, the farthest subject is near infinity. So the closest one does play a role. In Let's take a look at yours, Adam. Again, you've got some grass in the foreground of your shot, and I can tell that it's slightly out of focus. Where in this frame did you focus the camera?
Like all the way at the end of the path.
Okay,
like, at the far end.
Far end, yeah, far end of the path.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we'll get into that mistake in a little bit.
Well, that's the next question, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Well, well,
I wrote down the notes. Why does Adam make so many mistakes?
Oh, well, perfect.
Yeah.
It's a teaching tool.
The mystery will be solved.
trying to move the podcast along here.
Right. So in this case, Adam, you want to have an aperture that will allow you to get everything in focus, but the aperture is only one part of that equation.
Well, but what aperture would that be? Like when you go to take a... do you have a benchmark that you think of in your head? Like, all right, I'm going to start at F8 and work up or down, or is there somewhere a starting point that you used on?
Between F8 and F16 is typically where I start.
Okay. As did I. When I went out the door, I understood that I'd be, you know, at F11.
That's what mine was. Hey, I did something right.
There you go.
There you go. F8 is typically the sweet spot in a lot of lenses. You typically get the sharpest results at that setting. But if you need a little bit more depth on that, if your foreground or background elements are a little bit out of focus, then I'll kick that up to F16. I typically don't push the camera any farther beyond that unless I have to. Because when you start to get closer to F22, or some lenses will let you get to F32, you hit a small bit of diffraction limiting, which is a much bigger problem in macro photography. But the idea is that everything becomes a little bit softer. Mm-hmm. And it's the problem that you see with your pinhole camera, Alan, where everything becomes unacceptably soft, but everything's in focus at the same time. So you want to avoid that if it's at all possible, because that crisp sharpness is what you need if you want to do anything grand with the photograph. If you want to take it, make a big print of it, you want to have that critical sharpness as great as it can be. And anything beyond F16 in most cameras will start to notice a tiny bit of softness coming into the mix.
Okay, so you got your F11, you got a 24 mil lens, let's say.
Yep.
And so you're going to get a pretty good depth of field. Now, where do you focus?
One third of the way between your closest subject and your furthest distance.
They should have a name for that.
I think it's called the hyperfocal distance.
Blam. I haven't wrote that down.
Have you talked about hyperfocal distance before?
Maybe. With my wife, though, and she's pretty bored.
No, I thought we did.
I'm pretty sure we've discussed the basic idea of hyperfocal distance.
Okay. Well, the idea is that, without getting into all the physics of it, if you focus at a point in a scene, the focus won't fall off perfectly forward and backward from that point. If you go, if you were to look 2 meters forward from that, you know, walking away from the camera, and 1 meter towards the camera, each of those points would have about the exact same fall off of focus.
Meaning, so how we described it before is, let's say you have 3 meters of acceptable focus from front to back. If you focus on your subject, you're not going to have 1.5 meters behind and 1.5 meters in front. That entire thing is shifted, so it'll be 1 meter in front and 2 meters behind. Ideally, so, I beg to differ with some of these the lenses and using the autofocus system. I don't know if that's what it is. I find different results from when I use my old FD lenses on my Canon, on my old Canon film camera. It could just be user error. I don't know, but I find that the 1/3 in front and 2/3 behind is not always typical.
If you take a look at the average lens, that some of them will have the focus markings on them that you can actually look through and see how close it is on a little barrel. And if you notice, the physical distance on those lenses between like 1 foot and 2 foot, like the amount that you have to spin that focus on the camera is about the same as the distance between like 50 feet and infinity. And so you can use that as a bit of a measurement tool to say that the camera will have to physically change the focusing of the camera more over closer distances than it will over farther distances.
Mm-hmm.
And while the 2/3 forward, 1/3 back rule is a good rule of thumb, I'm sure that if you dig into the equations, you'll find all sorts of exceptions to it.
Sure. So, but anyway, what you're saying is in Adam's photo, to get the best focal acceptable focus across the entire image, where should he have focused? Instead of the far end of the path, essentially at infinity where he's focused, where would you have focused?
Maybe at the point where the fence line ends, which is roughly where the person in the purple jacket is.
Right.
And that's just me guessing right now, but oftentimes you're not going to measure out a scene. You're just going to have to make that guess. And in the digital world, you can make the guess. If you're wrong, then you can adjust it from there. But the key is not to limit yourself to focus on a particular subject. Focus in between the subjects if you have to, but as long as you're one third of the way into the scene between them, mm-hmm. you should get some pretty good results.
And that's what I ended up doing on my award-winning photo. I mean, this people will confuse mine with Ansel Adams. That's inevitable. But that's what I did on mine. I did focus about a third of the way in, sort of towards the edge of those lily pads or whatever those are, the clutter that I have. And that's what I focused to get the most, make sure all the clutter was in focus. That was the idea.
Oh, good.
So, in that respect, check one in the win column. What time of year? So now that we know where to focus, how to set it all up. Well, first of all, what's the framing? Like, what are we looking at for framing? For where's the horizon line go?
Well, I mean, if you follow the rule of thirds, the horizon line would go at either one third of the way up the frame or two-thirds of the way up the frame, depending on what part of the image is most prominent. But that's a rule that is so commonly broken.
I don't like that rule. I thought it was just me.
And so, like, if you look at my image here, the horizon is kind of near center compared to – it's a little bit lower, but it's not a rule that I follow very solidly.
Three of our images are pretty close to the center.
Yeah, yeah. And so it doesn't really matter, but – it's a guide, and the reason why that rule exists is to tell you that the image needs to have a focus somewhere. You need to have something to guide you through the image, and if you're dividing everything equally, then you will likely have, in the grand scheme of things, if you stereotype it, competing elements. And that might make it harder for you to navigate through a scene. So these rules are designed to take the generalization of what most people will encounter and try to avoid some of those common pitfalls. But I find a lot of landscapes will work perfectly fine with the horizon right smack in the center. Just depends on what your subject is.
Okay. So what time of year is it best to take landscape photos?
Again, it depends on what you're after. Fall is a great time of the year because you've got some nice colored foliage that can add some dynamic color contrasts to a scene. It'll also, as I mentioned, have a higher chance of finding mist and fog around, which can add extra depth to a landscape. So fall is a preferred time of the year for our landscape photographer to get out there and get shooting. But I've made great landscape photographs on some of the coldest winter days. Early spring is a good time. Midsummer, depending on what you're after, it's a great time for infrared photography, and certain types of landscapes will excel in there as well. Depending if you're trying to add wildlife to it, then migration patterns, follow the bird migrations, and that's the time of the year. There's depending on what you're after, you could go at any day of the year, 365, and make a great landscape picture.
So let's say you're brand new at this, you want to get out there and try it. I recommend people try it in the fall because there's a lot more room for error.
But if you're brand new at it and it's the spring, you're not going to wait until the fall.
Do it. Wait. Just don't waste your time in the spring.
just keep the camera in the box.
Go get Netflix and watch Breaking Bad or something. You got some other stuff to do. What time of day do we go out and shoot landscapes?
Golden hours are usually best. So that's the hour right after sunrise and the hour right before sunset. Now, if you were to go out at midday, you'll have very harsh light. That the same reason why it's a terrible time to go out and shoot a portrait is the same reason why it's not that great to go out and shoot a landscape. The shadows in those golden hours add a lot of depth, and they actually work to hide certain amounts of clutter. They'll add extra lines to an image, and landscape photography is a lot about leading lines and navigating through that frame. And if a shadow can create strong diagonal lines, which they most often do, then there's a compositional element that you don't have to go and search for. It's right there. So those are the two best times. I would favor the morning because you'll have a little bit more depth to play with, but sunsets are very beautiful as well. There's one landscape that I had done That had, I knew exactly where the sun was going to rise, and I knew that there was going to be mist on the water that morning. And so I got out there for sunrise just as the sun crept over the horizon, and it backlit the mist, and it glowed like fire. And I knew that was going to happen, and I just lined it all up. And there's no way that that could have been possible if I had gone out and shot at the evening golden hour. Mm-hmm. So there's certain advantages to either.
So you're saying 6 a.m. on September 22nd, and if you miss that window, forget it.
Yeah, 6 a.m. September 22nd or 7th, depending on what's coming up, or both those dates have passed, so next year, with a 24-millimeter lens at f/16, and you're good to go. Yeah, you're perfect. You'll get an award winner right there.
We should have done this last week. Now, when you go to shoot a landscape photo, I mean, we discussed that, hey, it's going to be, you know, the scape of the land, hence the name. Do you have a subject? Do you look for a subject in your shots? Is it important?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, you want to have those connecting elements that lead yourself through the scene. If you don't have a subject, there's a very good chance that your photograph won't be able to tell a very strong story. And landscapes don't often tell stories, but it can even be just some blades of grass some sort of reeds in water that are casting reflections, and you can see almost like a sense of isolation, but it tells a story. And you don't need to have like a person to be your subject. That subject can be a blade of grass. It can be an animal. It can be a rock. It can be any type of natural formation. It could be a flower. You know, anything that can grab your attention and can make you somehow relate to it in some way.
Okay. And potentially distinguish it from other photos at the exact same location.
Exactly. And something, the best landscape photographs that I've been a huge fan of will have a mix of water and rocks and reeds and something that grabs your eye in the foreground, that's relatively simplistic, that might lead to either a continuously simplistic background or something that connects in and adds drama or potential to it. If I'm looking at the challenge photos here, you can see in Adams, his subject is the cyclists going down the path. And because they're not in the foreground, I'd want to kind of crop off the foreground, as I had mentioned, to make them that first thing that I gravitate to. And from there, the story will begin to play out. But if they're not presented first, then the story is not usually as strong. And the same thing with yours, Alan, that the primary subject is sort of at the background of this particular scene. There's nothing much in the middle ground or the foreground aside from some clutter and some lily pads that are not that strong. Mm-hmm. So again, having that first thing that you look at, that's got to be that anchor. It's got to start to tell that story. And in my case, it was a swan. And so I think that adds a little bit more depth to it, and it helps you look through the scene.
Where does the foreground end and where does the middle ground begin? Are those precise points? You know, you describe it as if that's a definite foreground, middle ground, background. Like what makes up each of those?
Just something at different parts of the scene. If you could divide the frame into thirds, you know, if we're doing like the third rule kind of stuff, and if you have something in the bottom third, something in the middle third, and something in the top third, that would be a good way to generalize having something in the foreground, middle ground, and background in the classic stereotypical landscape photograph. In your case, if you were to divide it up that way, Adam, the foreground would be the grass, the middle ground would be the bikers, and the background would be the mountains and the village and the town in the background.
Now, Adam, but did you seek to include foreground in your shot on purpose?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you just say yes.
Sure.
Good job, Adam. That's what I try. I had difficulty getting the clutter out of the way, but I did every photo I took, I sought to include foreground, because the middle ground is going to happen. The background obviously is going to happen for the most times. And for me, adding that foreground became very, very important. No, for real, because otherwise...
No, just the way you said it was funny.
It, well, I always find, especially when I do portraits and that, I don't like to have oftentimes I don't like to have, you know, just people and an out of focus background. I like to have some sort of a middle ground to add depth and a sort of a realism or a connection to realism in the photo, as opposed to just looking like a photoshopped background.
Exactly. Now, the foreground, middle ground, background could happen, you know, vertically as I had just described, but it could happen horizontally. It can happen just based on, like, all within the same space too. You can be shooting through a window into something else, and that can still, in some ways, be considered a landscape. You know, whether it's a man-made window or shooting through like the trunk of a tree that has a hole in it or something of that nature. And there's different ways to include these elements together. You know, creativity is your limitation. But as long as you've got something that guides your eye through the scene at usually three different points is pretty good, where you can, where you know if you look at a photograph that you're going to hit point A, point B, point C. And the fewer of those points above three, the better. Because if you have too many points that you could potentially look at, then you might just wander around not knowing what the image is supposed to be read to be.
I think the key, the more I look at your photo, now I look at it every single time. I go right to the bottom left swan.
Yep.
Every time, bam, there he is. It's like you did it on purpose, Don.
I think I did.
Nice.
And then for me, I'll navigate my eyes to where it's looking, which is to that second swan.
Yep.
And so you hit those two points, and then you'll often look either to the lily pads in front or the clouds in the background. Mm-hmm. And so that's a pretty good compromise there. If you can predict roughly how somebody is going to look through the photograph with relative certainty, like there's only a few ways that you can interpret this particular photograph. The fewer, the better, because it's if you were to write a paragraph, if you were to, you know, write a short story or something, the fewer interpretations on like a simple sentence is usually better. Because if you get too many variances, then it's probably just you wrote a bad sentence. Your English isn't good.
Unless it's the movie The Shining, and then it gets crazy.
Well, yeah, but there's always exceptions to it.
Yeah. The last question about landscapes, filters. Which filters do you recommend having in your bag and then putting on your camera?
So I always recommend having a polarizing filter. And like we discussed, in extremely wide angle lenses, it might not suit for a sky. But a polarizing filter will add richness and depth to foliage. It will cut through reflections on water. There's a lot of elements to polarization that are very helpful to remove clutter and keep the focus in a landscape photograph. So I keep a circular polarizer in my camera bag, and that usually works pretty well. I don't use it all the time. It's not like it's always on my camera. But if the situation, you know, has that sky that needs a bit of extra drama or color that needs to pop a bit more, the polarizer is a great thing to have. Beyond that, if I have running water in my scene, I'll often have a neutral density filter in my camera bag, and that just stops light from coming in so that I can get a slower shutter speed if I'm shooting in brighter light, if I'm, you know, pushing the limits of the golden hour and I've got more light to deal with than the scene needs to get a slower shutter speed, then a neutral density filter can come in handy. Now, the old guard photographers
you're often a mind reader, Don.
What's that?
You're a mind reader. I was waiting for an in to ask what filter they had. Go ahead.
Okay. They would use a graduated neutral density filter, which would block out a lot of light, but only on half the frame. And so this would be like usually a square filter. The top half would appear visually darker. The bottom half would be clear, and there would be a gradient between them that sort of feathered it so that it became sort of a soft transition. And this would be used in the era of film quite readily, because oftentimes the sky was too bright compared to the brightness of the rest of the landscape. Mm-hmm. So if you could selectively darken down the sky but leave the landscape, the rest of the scene, still brighter, you'd have a better compromise on dynamic range, and the scene would look closer to what we would see with our own eyes.
It's early HDR.
It's early HDR. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that you could have done at the time. But now I find it so much easier. Like, if you want to go through that exact same approach, don't worry about fiddling with a filter in front of your camera and trying to learn that technique. Just bracket your shots. And for me, it's so easy to just bring two shots into Photoshop and create a layer mask and blend the two together in the exact same way. And then I've got the creativity to choose exactly where that's going to fall. Mm-hmm. In the classic way to do it, if you had like a tall tree that was jutting up through the horizon line, you know, the top of the tree would also become darker, and there's no real way around that unless you're a whiz in the dark room and you could go in and selectively dodge certain parts of the image. But in the digital world, you can create that basic gradient and then go in and adjust the mask with the brush tool and quickly get perfect results without the need of graduated ND filters.
So if I want to go and look in the library or online and look at some classic landscape photos, whose photos am I going to look for first?
Well, all the classic landscape photographers pretty much used this kind of stuff. I'm not sure specifically.
I'm looking for one name. One name comes to mind when you think classic landscapes.
Ansel Adams,
correct. That's who we're and that's who I think who I would think of and who I'd look for first.
But Ansel Adams did a lot in the darkroom as well. If you're looking at his simple use of filters, it might be a little bit misleading because well he did a lot of the stuff that came after the fact perfected the shot.
Okay.
So again, if Ansel Adams was around today, I'm sure he would embrace the digital workflow for this kind of stuff just as much as he did all the tricks of the trade of his era.
That's I've heard the similar thing posited. Yes. So check out Ansel Adams and then go from there, and there's a lot of other great examples, of course.
Yeah, and I should mention, I know it's been mentioned on the show before, that a lot of people, like every time you go out somewhere, you've got other photographers around you that have a UV filter on the front of the camera. And back in the film era, a UV filter would have cut out UV haze in the background, which would have faded out some details in far distant scenes because the film was sensitive to UV light and some of the UV light would bounce off particles in the atmosphere and bounce back to the camera and cause some fading as you go to very long distances towards the infinity horizon. In the digital workflow, you've got a filter in front of your sensor that prevents that. So a UV filter has absolutely no benefit for landscape photography today. And I always recommend using a lens hood instead, because mm-hmm. if you're looking to protect the camera, then that lens hood is going to offer you, all the same protection pretty much, unless you have a projectile, coming straight towards your lens. And then I question what you're taking pictures of. And you get better optical quality because stray light coming from weird angles is not going to be entering your lenses as easily.
Right. Great. Anything else you want to know about landscape photography, Adam?
That's a tough one.
I think we have enough there to get started and go take better photos than we did.
Yes. Now, one further thing to mention, and I think that it was in the notes, but we kind of grazed over it. You can do a landscape in a vertical position as well. It doesn't have to be a horizontal image. I've done a fair amount of night landscapes that are done in a vertical position to capture more stars in the sky. So just be free to experiment. Landscapes can take any shape or form, whether it's horizontal, vertical, or square. I've seen a lot of great square landscapes too.
Right. So you don't have to just go out and shoot, because I automatically think, wide angle, like wide open vistas, and therefore that's what a landscape is. However, when I did take mine yesterday, I took a few in the portrait, and they were equally bad, so I didn't include them. But that wasn't why they were bad.
I did one in the Yukon where I had a stream flowing through this valley with some mountains in the background, and there wasn't a whole lot useful on the left and the right, but there was a nice vertical composition to be made there, and so I shot it vertically, and I much preferred it to the horizontal one that I also shot. It depends on the scene, but don't feel like you're limited to shooting horizontal. In fact, I'd almost encourage people to go out and intentionally try to shoot a vertical landscape, because then you'll be paying attention to different elements, and you might be a bit more creative that way.
Great. I'm going to do that. Next week's challenge, Adam.
Yeah.
Is to try to stay awake until 11.
that was a real yawn. That was not faked.
No, we don't phone it in here on the show. Next week's challenge. This one's going to be kind of a wide open one.
Okay.
Your favorite.
Is it wide open?
No. That would be too literal.
Okay.
It's the next week's challenge is your favorite technique.
Please don't make it a vertical landscape.
That's what it is. It's your favorite technique. Whatever your go-to technique is right now, whatever you're using and doing all the time, be it lighting or outside, whatever you're shooting a lot of, that's what this challenge is. So yours will be different than mine, but it's going to be your favorite technique.
Whatever my favorite technique is.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
Great.
I meant to mention at the top of the show and forgot, Amazon. When you're buying stuff on Amazon, buy it through our site. Everybody wins.
Great. End.
Okay. And Don, where can people find your stuff?
Well, I'm pretty active on Google Plus.
So you're really active on Google Plus.
Yeah, my latest and greatest stuff is always there. And if you write me, I write back. And it's a great interactive environment. I love the way they display images full screen, full res. And so if you want to see some of my work in all its glory, go check it out there.
Okay.
And you can find a link to my Google Plus page and everywhere else I am online on my portfolio website. That's doncom.ca. And you'll find links to my Snowflake book and stuff there too.
Go. If you haven't ordered the book, during the crowdfunding phase, good news is you can still buy one.
Yep, you can pre-order it on my website, and after release, I'm hoping to have it in some more mainstream retailers as well.
Right, and you likely don't have a Snowflake book on your bookshelf yet, so go ahead and pick one up.
Exactly, yeah, it's the perfect gift for somebody who has everything.
Well put.
Except for a Snowflake book.
I think we read into that, Adam.
Okay.
Do you want me to edit that part out so you don't seem silly?
No. Leave that in, please.
Okay. Adam, where can people find your stuff?
SchwartzChronicles.com and the Two Hosers Facebook page.
That's a good spot. You can find my stuff at AlanAdridge.com and the two of us at TwoHosers.com, where you can find all the links that we just described, including the Amazon and doncom.ca. So that's it. Until next week. I want to say thanks to Don and Adam for joining us. And, hang on. Let's thank Don for joining us, Adam, because you're here every week.
That's right. Thanks, Don.
I just shot myself in the foot being polite.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You know what? Get out there and make better photos.